Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. It was billed as a conference to save the world. By the end, it could barely save itself. Copenhagen eked out a 2.5-page accord that nations present took note of. No deadline for a treaty, no emissions cuts requirements, a recipe for hell on earth, says one of my guests today. But others see a get real accord for action. This hour, On Point, top environmentalists who were on the scene on what happened in Copenhagen and what comes next. You can join the conversation. What did you expect from Copenhagen? What did you see delivered? You can also comment at our website, onpointradio.org, or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Joining me first today from Middlebury, Vermont, is Bill McKibben, writer, high-profile environmentalist, and founder of 350.org, an international climate activism campaign. He was in Copenhagen watching, blogging. He led a rally with Maldives President Mohamed Nasheed. His dispatches were published in the online magazine Grist. Bill McKibben, thank you for joining us.
Tom, as always, what a pleasure.
Hell on Earth, a headline from The Guardian from one of your pieces. What do you see having come out of this, Bill? Your posts were pretty bleak.
Well, look, there was a strong sense going in that the science has been getting steadily darker, that we need a real and profound shift to happen. That shift didn't come out of Copenhagen. What came out of Copenhagen was, as you described it, a 2.5-page memo with no numbers attached to it. Doesn't say how much anybody plans to cut anything. It doesn't say when they plan to cut it. It basically says that the U.S. and China will figure this out going forward. It may make it, because it's so completely unthreatening, it may make it a little easier to get some kind of bill through the U.S. Senate, and that may help unclog that part of the process a little bit. But the problem is that we're up against a scientific wall here. Our backs are against it because each new issue of science or nature makes it clear that the science is getting harder and harder and harder. We needed breakthrough change. We didn't get breakthrough change. We probably came out with less than we started with. So I think they're outside of a few inside the Beltway environmental groups, pretty much the whole rest of the world, as far as I can tell by reading headlines and commentary from around the planet, pretty much everybody else is discouraged by this. And in some ways, the most telling numbers may have come yesterday morning when the markets opened, and it was very clear that clean tech stocks and carbon prices were plummeting. The people who have money on the line were deeply discouraged with the Copenhagen Accord. As one of the analysts at Barclays Capital put in their note to clients, you could call it Nopenhagen or Fiascopenhagen or Slopenhagen or what you will, but you couldn't call it very much of a success. And I'd give anything to be telling you the opposite. There were good things that we noted there. One was the vibrant emergence of a real global civil society movement. We helped nurture that at 350.org. In October, we had what CNN called the most widespread day of political action in the planet's history. One measure of its success was that all kinds of small, poor countries didn't back down as easily as they usually do to the U.S. and China. They wouldn't sign off on the kind of face-saving agreement that Obama wanted. And that's one of the reasons that in the end, the U.S. and China had to cut them out of the process, say, we're not going to deal with these annoying small nations going on and on and on about their survival anymore. And we're also not going to deal with crazy nations like Sudan making absurd comparisons with the Holocaust. We're just going to go do this on our own, and that'll be that.
Bill McKibben, stand by there if you would. I want to get another voice into our conversations. Let's just hear just a bit first from the end. Here's the official decision of the Conference of the Parties, as it was called, delivered on Saturday afternoon in Copenhagen.
The Conference of the Parties decides to take note of the Copenhagen Accord of the 18th of December 2009.
And here's a weary President Barack Obama speaking from Copenhagen on Friday after a full day of negotiations with the heads of China, Brazil, India, South Africa. The talks, their talks produced the Copenhagen Accord.
Today we've made meaningful and unprecedented, made a meaningful and unprecedented breakthrough here in Copenhagen. For the first time in history, all major economies have come together to accept their responsibility to take action to confront the threat of climate change.
President Obama at the end of his efforts in Copenhagen. Joining us now from Washington, David Doniger, Policy Director of the Climate Center of the Natural Resources Defense Council. It's an environmental advocacy group. He served in the Clinton administration as Director of Climate Change Policy at the Environmental Protection Agency, was part of the U.S. delegation that negotiated the Kyoto Protocol, attended the climate talks in Copenhagen as an official observer for the NRDC. David Doniger, thank you very much for joining us.
Hi, Tom. Thank you very much.
I know you've just jumped on here. Bill McKibben is pretty bleak in his assessment of what's come out of Copenhagen. The path to hell on earth is a headline that came off of one of his essays out of there. You're more positive. Why?
Well, I think this actually is a big breakthrough. I mean, it's true that the path of emissions that we're on now is deadly, is disastrous. I like Bill's phrase of hell on earth. We're headed to a bad place. But we weren't changing that going in the last 2 years of negotiations going up to the Copenhagen meeting. Those negotiations were deadlocked, were going nowhere. And what we had at the end was a highly unusual summit. Most of the time presidents and prime ministers fly in to put their stamp on something that's already been negotiated. In this case, President Obama and the leaders of throughout the day between 5 and 25 big countries and small countries, they actually hammered out the agreement. He had a right to be tired and bleary-eyed at the end of the day because he'd flown overnight, spent 13 hours hammering this thing out, and then was headed home again. But let's talk about what's in it. It has the first agreement between the United States, the big developing countries like China, and, of course, Europe and Japan, the countries that make up 80 to 85% of the world's emissions, the first agreement that all of them are going to start controlling their pollution. The problem that we've been stuck on with the Kyoto Protocol and the negotiations since then is getting over that threshold where all the big emitting countries agree to start doing things. Now, it's true that what they have agreed to do in this first step is not enough to prevent the climate catastrophe that Bill rightly warns against. But it is a start, and you have to get them on the treadmill in order to speed up the treadmill. And I think that's the key thing that's been done here. It's truly a breakthrough in that regard. The old organization, the Conference of the Parties, does not work. It has in it some countries that represent the conscience of the world, like the small island states and the African nations, who are really going to get the brunt of global warming. But it also has got, as Bill mentioned, the OPEC states, regimes like the Sudan, Hugo Chavez's Venezuela. Those guys are standing in the way of every progressive move that anyone tries to take, and even any moderate move that the big countries decide to take.
David Doniger, hold the thought there, if you would. I want to get Bill McKibben's response, and we'll come right back to you. But, Bill, how about on this point? You write about it as, you know, you say Obama blew up the United Nations, formed a league of super polluters. You hear David Doniger says,
saying that we needed to blow up the UN and create that league because they're the only ones who can solve the problem. Well, look, that's the best spin you can put on it, and inside the Beltway, there's something to be said for it. America's political system is so dysfunctional, and our Congress so unwilling to deal with scientific fact that perhaps the only way you can do this is to completely cater to their unwillingness to do anything serious. The bill that everybody inside the Beltway is working on at the moment is remarkably weak, but they'll make the same argument for it. It's a first step someplace. I think the point is that the science now makes clear that if we have any hope of dealing with this, it's going to be not with a slow, gradual, incremental, one tiny step at a time, come back in 10 years and do something else sort of step, which, by the way, we haven't even taken. There aren't any numbers in this agreement. Mm. But it's going to have to be done with a truly dramatic kind of wartime footing sort of thing. I think that, for the most part, the U.S. and China decided they didn't like their inability to intimidate small island nations and things into shutting up and wanted to cut them out of the process. There was more civil society than they wanted. In fact, Copenhagen itself was a kind of interesting analog for this. There were 20,000 NGO representatives there, registered, and, you know, the UN knew they were coming. But by the second week, all but a couple of hundred had been told they were no longer welcome in the hall, that there wasn't room for them.
On the other side of the fence, the police batons.
There remained plenty of room, of course, for, you know, every oil company representative in the world. But the point was people were making too much noise. So now we'll have a quiet, orderly process where the what we're really sort of going to have is an AA meeting, but among people who continue to drink in enormous quantities.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We are talking this hour with environmental activists back from Copenhagen about how they see what happened there and the global road ahead. David Doniger is with us from the Natural Resources Defense Council's Climate Center. Bill McKibben is here, environmental activist, founder of 350.org, International Climate Activism Campaign. They were both in Copenhagen, very different interpretations of what just went on there. Here's a handful of voices from Copenhagen last week. First, Kumi Naidu, head of Greenpeace International, saying developed nations have let developing nations down in Copenhagen.
It's a real betrayal, I think, of particularly the most vulnerable countries, those that are already losing lives as a result of climatic impacts. Small island states and least developed countries in particular have been completely let down. And for them, actually, the failure to actually make progress here is essentially a death warrant for their futures.
A death warrant for their futures, he says. Here's Mohamed Nasheed, president of the island nation of the Maldives, saying the Copenhagen Accord was insufficient but a start. His country stands to get up to billions in dollars in aid for climate change adaptation.
I understand that this is not a complete document, but it has features that it can migrate to become a completely binding and a very good planet-saving document.
It can migrate, maybe migrate and save the planet. And here's Sudanese diplomat Lumumba Diaping, lead negotiator for the Coalition of Developing Countries, saying the final accord, codenamed L9, amounted to a death sentence for millions. He likened it to the Holocaust.
L9 asked Africa to sign a suicide pact, an incineration pact, in order to maintain the economic dominance of few countries.
Diaping went on to say it's a solution based on the same values that funneled 6 million people in Europe into furnaces, just about as rough as language can be there. Bill's calling from Northborough, Massachusetts. Bill, what do you see?
Thank you for taking my call. After this conference, I've come to the conclusion that we as a species are simply too stupid to live. I mean, the science is there. All the indications are there. There's no denying it, yet we found a way to deny it anyhow. I thought I was depressed after reading Bill McKibben's book there, The End of Nature. After this conference, I'm coming away with no hope whatsoever.
Well, look, here's the thing.
Bill.
It's fair to be despairing and depressed, and I am in certain ways. But the idea that humans in general are too stupid to do anything about this is incorrect. We've got, finally, a real movement going. As I said, in October, we had 5,200 simultaneous demonstrations in 181 countries around the world, by far the most widespread day of political action on any issue ever. And it wasn't people rallying around movie stars. It was people rallying around a scientific data point, 350 parts per million CO2, which the scientists tell us is the most we can have in the atmosphere. The problem is not that humans are the problem is that we have a system where a few nations are finding it, and a few vested interests within those nations are finding it to their short-term interest to delay action that most people who've studied the situation with any seriousness know we need to take. So the question is, how do we overcome those vested interests? And David, you know, may be quite right in saying the only way to do it is this slow way of buying them off one by one in order to get 60 votes on a Senate thing that's a terrible bill to begin with so that we can go a little further down the road and get – that may be. The hope was Obama was going to take this with deep seriousness and that he was going to come in and push real hard. Not in the last 13 hours, but in the last year.
Bill,
use that time to really make deep change happen. That didn't happen, so now we got to hope that we got some other way out.
David, I'm going to come to you. Let me get one more call, and I'll be right to Lawrence in Heartland, Vermont. Lawrence, you're on the air.
Thanks for taking my call.
Yeah.
I just wanted to counter this doom and gloom with a little bit of history. If one looks back at the Hague Conference 100 years ago, where they spent a great deal of time trying to avoid a global conflict, and they weren't successful in the first instance, in the second instance either. We're involved here in a global process, and global processes are very, very difficult to steer through. It's a very difficult course, and it's a huge ship of state that has to be steered. The same thing applies to many things that happen within the Senate right now in these very large-scale bills.
Mm.
In German, we have a word called the salami tactic. That means take off one slice of salami at a time and just keep moving forward. And I think that's really how global processes work. I don't think that you can expect to have massive breakthroughs in any...
Is there time for slicing the salami, Lawrence? Is there time?
Yes, there's time to slice the salami as long as you keep slicing it. If anybody's ever watched a butcher slot salami, it can go very quickly if it has to, but it has to keep going forward.
Lawrence, we've got it. David Doniger, let me come to you. You hear the hopelessness of our first caller, our second caller willing to hang in. Bill McKibben, quite critical of incrementalism here. Take us on through your analysis of why you see hope.
First of all, I don't think that this is a tiny slice of salami, and I don't. This is a big chunk that has been done. It is also not a closed shop of big polluters only. The new agreement will involve the small island states, will involve the Africans, will involve any of the countries which, to use the expression of the president of the Maldives, which choose to migrate into that agreement. And it will need a new governance structure, which means that they have to decide, frankly, what the role is for observers like us and like Bill. They'll have to decide whether it's going to be a closed shop or, in that respect, or whether it's going to be open. There's a lot of interesting decisions to be made. But we know that it will start with the countries that, the big countries that joined it already, putting down in a formal way the emissions reduction pledges that they made during the past year. They will no longer be isolated one-off statements, one made on, you know, on November 20th and another made on December 5th. They will make these pledges to each other. They will agree to a transparency structure so they can measure each other's performance. And then there's a way to ratchet this forward. And if you look at the history of the climate negotiations from 1997 to 2009, nothing has been achieved in the formal negotiations except some vague principles. No emission reductions.
So are you making here, David, if I may ask, the get real argument? Is this the argument that says Copenhagen got real? And what is meant by that? Help us understand that.
Well, I think what you have is a concrete commitment from the United States to finally join in, and from China, India, South Africa, Brazil, other big countries in the developing world to join in. Now, if they had to march, if the only step they could take is the step that protects us against 2 degrees, all in one step, you would not get them to step over the threshold. Now we have to get them to do what they said and very quickly to up what they said. And we can do this. See, it's the way we solved the problem of the ozone layer. We didn't start with the perfect solution. We got to it in about 5 steps.
Was it too much to ask for emissions to be specified, for levels to be specified?
They will be. The leaders who negotiated this knew that all of them, basically all the big countries, had put specific offers on the table. We know what they are. They were announced
that's the problem.
We know what they are.
And they
will be wrapped up in this agreement by the end of January.
Bill McKibben?
David's right about timetable. The problem is we know what they are. We know what the outer limits of what they're willing to contemplate or promise are, and we know what they add up to. In the middle of Copenhagen, a document leaked out from the UN that had my name scrawled all over the front, but it's not because I leaked it, I promise. It's because it showed that the UN knew something that I'd been saying for quite a while was in fact correct, that even if you add up all the promises, the most outlandish and insanely optimistic promises that all the countries are making, you end up with at least 3 degrees Celsius rise in temperature. Indeed, the one attempt to do this on a real systematic and independent basis from a team at MIT says that, which has a computer program that lets you do it almost instantaneously, says if you take the most wonderful promises that every country has made, even things that they have no intention of doing, the world that it creates by 2100 is about 600 parts per million CO2, or closer to 700 actually, about twice what is safe. Here's the problem. I get the political realism argument. It's obvious and understandable, and it is how other problems work. Our problem is that our adversary here is not China. It's not the Republicans. Our adversary here is physics. And that's a tough bargaining partner because physics has this stubborn insistence on naming its bottom line, in this case 350 parts per million CO2, and then sticking to it no matter how nice you are to it, no matter how much you explain the difficulties of changing your system overnight, no matter how much you talk about the economic bad time that you're in. Yesterday in Nature, a new article came out, showed that when the temperature last rose 1.3 degrees, the sea level rise was, in fact, much, much higher than we'd thought, about 9.4 meters or 30 feet. This agreement puts us on the path to completely blow past that 1.3 degree mark very, very quickly and with no hope of ever getting back to it. That's what our leaders are signing onto. What I'm trying to say is if that's the process, we've got to, in an emergency, in an urgent way, in a dramatic way, come up with a new one. That's what people all over the world are demanding. The people who aren't getting it are the politicians who want to go very slowly.
David Doniger, do you agree it's still too modest what's on the table here? And if you think it can be ratcheted up, do you think the numbers can be ratcheted up under the kind of process we've seen?
Only if we build a very powerful movement very, very fast. And I think that there are things that happened in Copenhagen to deeply discourage that movement building up.
I want to ask you about that, but let me get David just on this issue of, you know, beginning numbers by maybe next month, you say, David, but do you agree with Bill that what's on the table is insufficient, and do you see a process that would push it up or defend low numbers?
No, look, I agree with Bill that the offers on the table are not enough to prevent the terrible warming that he correctly foresees, but they are enough to reduce it some and to start a virtuous cycle where one country acts and urges another country to act, and you ratchet your way up. Now, I've seen this work. I worked on the treaty to protect the ozone layer. If we hadn't eliminated the ozone-depleting chemicals, we'd all be blistering skin every time we walk outside by now. We'd all be, you'd have millions of people with skin cancer. And we solved this problem over the course of 10 years. It started with agreements between countries to cut these emissions by about a third over 10 years. And in the course of that 10 years, they accelerated what they agreed to. They said, well, we can do more. We can do more. This is not that hard once we got started. And we've eliminated 96% of all the ozone-depleting chemicals in the world. Now, Bill's movement, which he has built up with enormous sweat and tears, is critical, and it has to grow. But, you know, we don't get there in one meeting, and we don't even get there it's just going to take a while. There's no way around that. You know, to paraphrase Donald Rumsfeld, you legislate with the Congress you have, not the one you wish you had. You go to Copenhagen with the countries you have, not the ones you wish you had.
Bill, how about it? The countries you've got.
There's less distance between us, in a sense, than you think, because I completely agree with what David says. That at the moment, there's not the political will, especially in this country, probably in China too, to do what needs to be done, and we've got to make that happen. One way to make that happen is to keep pointing out that Barack Obama has done remarkably little. Yeah, he, you know, tried some in the last hours of this meeting, but it's not like this has been anywhere near the top of his agenda, and he's allowed in the Senate people to start cobbling together a bill that is far less cohesive and sensible even than the health care thing now unfolding. We need some real leadership from him. We need some real... He's the guy who could put the press corps on the airplane, on the Air Force One, and say, look, now we're going to go look at Glacier National Park, where there aren't going to be any glaciers in 20 years. Next, we're going to go look at the tens of millions of acres of dead pine trees across the western reaches of North America that are dying because of global warming. Then we're going to go look at the snowpack of the Sierra Nevada that every model we have tells us won't be there 70 years from now, and hence there won't be agriculture in California. We're going to do all these things, and we're going to really get the point across. Instead, he's decided that the only thing he really wants to talk about domestically is green jobs and clean energy because it's an easier sell. We need some real communication from a great communicator, someone I worked as hard as I knew how to put in office.
Bill, let me get a call right here before the break from Alabama, Dothan, Alabama. Jeff, you're on the air.
Yes, sir. I guess I wanted to just say that, you know, I'm not conversant in green speak. I don't know a lot about the science behind climate change, but I do know that on one hand I feel marketed at by, you know, green interests. On the other hand, I feel forced into supporting, you know, high emission creating interests. You know, mm-hmm. I drive a car around here because I have to,
right,
to get to work.
Of course.
But at the same time, really, so I don't know a whole lot about everything, but I do know that I'm from Birmingham, and when mm-hmm. when I walk out outside in my city, it's just, you know, I can't breathe. You know, there, you know, it's hot. It just feels unsafe. Yeah, you know, and it's I don't know about the future, but I hope there's a good one. And so I wish that I would be willing to put I'd be willing to forego.
Sounds like you're willing to change, Jeff. Jeff, we're losing you there, but we've got the point. There's
Amen
a man, not an environmentalist,
that.
But not feeling good about what he's seeing outside of Birmingham, Alabama there. Let's hold that thought. Let's let Jeff's words just sit in our ears while we take a short break here. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking with environmental activists just back from Copenhagen about what they see having happened there. And the global road ahead. Bill McKibben is with us from 350.org. David Doniger from the Natural Resources Defense Council. Here's President Obama speaking from a snow-blanketed White House the day after his return Saturday, acknowledging that the accord he helped broker was, as he said, just a start.
Going forward, we're going to have to build on the momentum that we established in Copenhagen to ensure that international action to significantly reduce emissions is sustained and sufficient over time. At home, that means continuing our efforts to build a clean energy economy that has the potential to create millions of new jobs and new industries. And it means passing legislation that will create the incentives necessary to spark this clean energy revolution.
A revolution, he says. After 17 straight hours of negotiation, Australian Prime Minister Kevin Rudd said on Saturday morning that the Copenhagen Accord was better than nothing.
This represents a significant global agreement A huge amount of work still remains to be done, but the alternative, which we confronted, staring into the abyss at midnight last night, was these negotiations collapsing altogether.
The alternative, said the Australian Prime Minister, an abyss. David Doniger, I've got a couple of from our email here. Here's one. Brad says, let the EPA regulate. The U.S. Senate is dysfunctional and obstructionist. It's corrupt, bought and paid for. And here's another from D. This goes to what Bill McKibben was saying, and I heard you trying to respond, David. D says, giving Obama credit for Copenhagen is his mission accomplished moment, another example of the change we voted for that isn't happening. But, David, I think I heard you rising in defense of the president's effort there. Share.
Look, I think the president is pushing really hard on a lot of things. And obviously health care is a very important thing, and it's taking up most of the country's political bandwidth. But this is a president who, in the middle of this economic crisis, has tackled he's not just been defensive, he's put out the health care and the climate change and energy agenda as his signatures. Now, you can do these things through the Congress one at a time, and it makes sense that he's focused on health care now. I expect and hope for a big push now after Copenhagen on climate and energy legislation next spring, and it's going to be extremely important that Bill McKibben's activist network lean into this as hard as they can. It's just amazing to me that people would think that think negatively of the efforts of Barack Obama on this. We have had 8 years of hell before this, no action, and we finally have someone who's leaning into this. And he personally brokered this agreement, made an agreement come out of nowhere. He's the one who got the Chinese to agree. He's the one who got the Brazilians and the South Africans and the Indians to come on board. And this is, he put $100 billion of assistance, public and private, to be shared out between the developed countries. That's not our share. It's a global share. $100 billion in assistance to the countries that are getting slammed by global warming. This real stuff happening here, and people should be excited by it, not depressed by it.
Bill, what about President Obama's effort? I mean, it was a wild series of hours there. Everybody says that if it hadn't been for him, there might not have been anything.
Yeah, I think what they were trying very hard to do was get some kind of face-saving agreement, and I think they barely, if at all, managed that. I got to tell you, this is not some kind of conceit of mine that this was a failure. If you read the press coverage from every national capital in the world, the tone is far worse than what I've been talking about. I was just looking at the Indian papers were describing it as a new Munich. The English papers were, the headline across the top of The Guardian was failure. And as I said earlier, the fairly dispassionate observers who dominate the stock markets made their verdict known yesterday when trading opened and clean tech stocks and carbon prices on the exchanges fell sharply.
Let me ask about...
They don't think that there's much here at all. Look, this is, for better or for worse, this is the world we now operate in, post-Copenhagen. The idea that we were going to get a dramatic, game-changing thing to happen out of Copenhagen has vanished. So now we live in the world that David is describing accurately, and so now we've got to go do what we can in that world. Part of that means not telling Obama all the time that because he's doing better than George Bush, doing better than George Bush on global warming is like doing better than George Wallace on racial healing. You know, this is not, the bar has not been set extremely high. We need now we'll find out. I mean, if he turns into a tiger on climate change, if he is the same as the next 6 months that he was in that 4 hours that David describes, then maybe we'll see something.
But let me
only going to happen if we push, and so we need people pushing.
Let me get your view on China. We've just lost David for a moment, but what about China's role here? There's a lot of, post-Copenhagen slings and arrows being thrown here. The British climate change minister, Edward Miliband, critical of China. China firing back today from Beijing.
Problem. Here's the problem. China's not being a huge help, but much of the problem is historical here. The U.S. caused this problem. It's our carbon that's up in the atmosphere that's heating the planet. And we're still producing
it in enormous volumes. The Chinese passed us last year as the biggest carbon emitter, but there's four times as many of them. If China split itself in four, it would have four countries the size of the U.S., and they'd only be emitting a quarter as much carbon. So the problem would be solved, right? Except nothing would have changed. So the Chinese are, I think, rightly sensitive to being described as the same kind of problem as the U.S. Obama gave them nothing. He went and lectured them when he got there. He may need to do that to keep the Senate in line, but in fact, a more generous historical understanding of how America has contributed to this problem probably would help loosen up this process some.
David Doniger, how do you see the global understanding of what's going to be required in terms of burden sharing evolving here?
I think there's an enormous progress in understanding on this. You know, if you go back even 1 year or 2 years, the developing countries would deny that they had any role in this, and they would take the position that the problem has to be solved by the United States and Europe and Japan. They don't feel that way anymore. Certainly they want the recognition that Bill points out, that their per capita contribution and their historical contribution is a lot less. But they know that their future contribution is going to be huge, and so they're willing to participate. Now, that is a tremendous crossing of the threshold from which we'll never go back. We'll only go forward. And I'm appalled at the wallowing in self-pity that's going on here, not just by Bill, but lots of people around the world. They couldn't possibly have expected Copenhagen to have produced what Bill is hoping for. It would always have been, even if it came out procedurally in a different way, it would have been a small step. And what was the plan? To declare that it was a waste and bring everyone down to despair? I don't think that's the way to get going.
I dramatically respect David's work and like all that he's doing and like all his friends at NRDC, but I think that the charge that we're wallowing in self-pity is over the top and incorrect. We've actually built a real global movement of people. It needs their understanding was, their hope was, and many of their leaders' willingness was to have this be a transformative conference. We've been trying to lower expectations for a long time with them because we knew that neither America nor China was in the mood for transformation. At best, we're willing to start taking the baby steps that David describes. It may well be that we're going to have to take those baby steps for a long time before we do any running. If we're going to do that, then we better accompany it with a good deal of fervent prayer that we get very lucky with the science, because as it stands right now, it looks like those baby steps are not going to be enough to get us, or even the strides that David envisions, are not going to be enough to get us out ahead of the curve of climate change. That's why we all hoped that there would be real running coming out of this conference, real urgency. We don't have any sense of that urgency. And you know what? The rest of the world, much of civil society is there. On the middle Sunday of this conference, first at the Great Cathedral in Copenhagen, and then at thousands upon thousands of churches around the world, the great bell rang 350 times to symbolize that understanding of the science. The shofar blew 350 times at synagogues around the world. There were mosques where people were reciting 350 verses from the Quran. People understand what needs to be done. The people who don't want that to be done, vested interests, fossil fuel interests, have too much power in both China and the U.S. That's why we're seeing the slow pace of change that we're seeing. Good for David to be fighting very hard to make that happen. Good for his colleagues. Don't accuse the rest of us of wallowing in self-pity. We're doing all that we can to build the momentum and the impetus for real change.
Let me get a call right here from Columbia, South Carolina. Christine, you're on the air.
Hey, Tom. Hey, y'all.
Hi.
I, I'm calling y'all from one of the most conservative states in the country, and I couldn't agree with your last speaker more. My feeling is we're not talking about saving the Earth. The Earth is going to live long after we're gone. We're talking about saving our ability to sustain our lives on this Earth, and we've reached a critical point. It's like either let's go do something, and we've got to do a lot now. The time of incremental changes making a real difference, that was 40 years ago. I mean, today's the day that we have to make dramatic change or we're done. And, you know, we make incremental changes, and I'm like, well, why bother? You know, why don't I just enjoy the lifestyle I have now, and why worry about it if that's all we're going to do? If we're going to get serious about this and make change that's really going to make a difference, that's really going to sustain our future as a human species on this planet, I'm all in. But if we're just going to play around and just make little kind of talky-talky efforts and little half a mile per gallon here change or a half a carbon credit here change or something, it's not enough. And I'm not dumb. I know that. And it's going to be hard to get me to buy into that.
Christine, we hear it. Our time is short, but that's a very interesting psychological kind of hinge point you're describing there. David Doniger, what do you say to Christine and Bill?
Well, I mean, I see this phenomenon where people have been turned on by Bill and by this larger movement to the enormity of this and to the needs that we have. But if what happens now is the last caller, that they check out because they're not seeing transformative change at the amazing pace they hoped for, well, you know, then we're done too, because the truth is, for all the efforts that Bill and his colleagues and we at NRDC have made to wake people up and turn people on, the activists are still a fraction. The people who are that charged up are still a fraction. And the reason the congressmen are not out there with a 350 vision is that they're not hearing from enough people. And that's just the way it is right now.
Let me get a couple more calls here, if I may, Joe. David, let me get a call from Joe in Iowa City, Iowa, to hear from the people. Joe, you're on the air.
It would seem to me that the only solution is going to be to price carbon somehow.
You bet.
The politicians obviously can't get anything done. And we talk about making sacrifice. I mean, in World War II, people were losing brothers, family members. The Iraq War, people are losing stuff. Mm. And to think that we don't have... it's not politically palatable to say electricity's got to go up by 15% or 25% or put a gallon, a 25-cent tax on a gallon of gasoline is completely unpalatable, seems to me a very sad state of affairs for the United States of America. I mean, if we talk about world leadership, we ought to start acting like world leaders instead of kowtowing to, as one of your guests mentions, the oil interests.
And pay for some of those carbon emissions. Joe, we've got it. And one more from Panton, Vermont. Eben, you're on the air.
Hi. My comment is that this whole, and in fact, just a quick bit of background. I actually walked with Bill McKibben through Vermont on one of his walking tours.
That's
I know
great.
The issue
take us
well,
to your point, Eben. Our clock is running down here.
Okay. I think that Copenhagen has shown us that politically, this is a dead game right now, and it is incumbent upon all of us as individuals to live the life in a smaller footprint. And as Americans, we are the worst that there is for living big. My wife and I have a 400 square foot house we live in with 5 light bulbs, and we are plenty happy. I use this as an analogy all the time: the paper cup. The number of progressive-minded people, thoughtful people out there, and they still use paper cups to get their cup of coffee. These are all these simple changes that need to happen in life, and we have to stop waiting for politicians to tell us what to do. We know these things. Bill will tell you that it's mountains of small changes to all of our lives that are going to make this happen, and let's stop waiting for politicians to do something. It's up to us. It's not up to
Eben, Eben, we've got it, and I thank you for your call. Bill McKibben, are you going to put your shoulder to the wheel in the year ahead?
Oh, of course. We'll all keep working. There's no self-pity in these parts. There's just absolutely straightforward, lucid realization that we are in a very tough place, that we're not seeing change anywhere near the pace we need it. And we need local action, and we need global action, and we'll do our best to figure out how to do it all and to keep pressing no matter who it offends.
And David Doniger, what's the next thing that Americans should look for to see whether or not there's progress on the, from the environmental perspective here?
Well, I really think the next thing this spring is to lean into the passing of a comprehensive climate and energy bill in the United States. The world is expecting the United States to act. And if we get split between progressives on whether it's good or not good enough, then the other side's going to win. So let's get together and work for the strongest bill through the Congress and get it done so the United States can start being a legitimate participant in this global effort to stop global warming.
David, Bill, will you promise to come back and talk with us about what's going on in the year ahead?
Of course, Tom. Have a very Merry Christmas.
And same to all. Good Christmas, good holidays. David Doniger at the Natural Resources Defense Council's Climate Center. Thank you, David.
Thank you very much.
Bill McKibben, author of the Bill McKibben Reader and head of 350.org. Same to you, Bill, and thanks very much for being with us today.
Take care, brother.
Listeners, you can continue the conversation and get the On Point podcast at our website, onpointradio.org, and follow us on Twitter and at Facebook at On Point Radio. Thanks for joining us. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.